a poem by Mae Sarton. The phoebe sits on her nest hour after hour, day after day, waiting for life to burst out from under her warmth. Can I weave a nest for silence? Weave it of listening, listening, layer upon layer? But one must first become small, nothing but a presence, attentive as a nesting bird, proffering no slightest wish, no tendril of a wish toward anything that might happen or be given. Only the warm, faithful waiting contained in one's smallness. Beyond the question, the silence. Beyond the answer, the silence. Tonight's talk is entitled A Full-Hearted Intention, and it's the second talk on wise intention from this series on the Eightfold Path. And if I could, I would just catch people up who might not have been here for the other talks. We're really examining the heart of the Buddha's teaching. The first thing out of his mouth, once he was awakened, the first dialogue, the first sermon, was these Four Noble Truths. And what we are doing is learning why it is that we have so much contraction around our life, so much pain. Sometimes we think it's circumstantial, sometimes we have a lot of sense of self-blame around that. Other times, it just seems to be the way our life is going, and in comparison to other people, not so well. And there's a kind of feeling of a growing disappointment that life isn't more than what we had hoped it to be, or even lives up to what we had hoped it to be. And this disappointment can become discouragement and despair. And so the Buddha looks at that particular problem. He looks at the rub of the eraser on the over time as it becomes worn away from the friction and resistance to living. And he said that he understood why that was occurring and that there was a way out of it. And he gave us a direction, a directive on how to get out of it. It's interesting, I read this poem tonight by Mae Sarton because I feel like she has caught some essence in her poetry that is very aligned with the Buddha's words when she talks about, but first, in order for me to capture, make a nest of silence, I have to become small. In fact, I have to be so small that I can't want anything, and I have to be just sitting in presence. And the attention there becomes a receptive attention where I can hear and listen and receive the world for what it is. And I appreciate that very much because that, in a sense, is the essence of wise view. We established that the first of the Eightfold Path, the orientation, the assumption we have about life has to be changed, that nothing is going to fix itself from carrying forth the assumptions that we already have placed upon the world. In fact, those assumptions are the very essence of why we have despaired in the beginning and in an ongoing way. Because a fear and desire must lead to further differentiation, further sense of separation and isolation, a further sense of being cut off or separated or distanced from. That fear and desire, by their very nature, are never going to allow us to feel like a community of spirit, aren't going to feel as if we are abiding in life, that we're going to have to section life off in order for us to desire it. And so there has to be two things. There has to be the thing I desire and me who is wanting it and trying to get over that desire and accommodate whatever the need might be. So the Buddha very clearly said that the path of greater differentiation is a path that will lead to greater suffering. And he also said that a path of greater interconnection, the more connected we are, the less we will suffer. The more connected we are, the less we are suffering. No matter where we start that sense of connection, no matter where we address it. And so then now we have the right orientation to the problem. Okay, so this problem is not outside of myself. I can't turn away from it. I can't get rid of it. I can't get over it. I can't get around it. I can't pretend it's not there in denial. I have to orient myself. I have to connect to it. The very thing that seems to be causing the despair from my limited understanding. And when I start using the wisdom and tools of the Eightfold Path, I understand that I have to orient myself to it. I have to move towards the difficult, not away from it. Now, all of these things are extraordinarily embedded in us to do just the opposite. And so I say that very simply, a couple of lines, we'll go on to the next line, and you say, oh, I got that down. Well, look at your life and see if you've got that down. Because if we don't have that down, then the embitterment will continue. Then the self-crisis, the deepening sense of despondency will just increase. And so when we begin to get a sense of how to orient ourselves to the difficulties and to life as a whole, that it must be done to bring us closer to it. And what we have been doing mostly is avoiding it, is trying to put distance, as much distance as we can from it, especially when it's unpleasant. This starts a whole new relationship to our life, or it should. It should get us, it should be an awakening slap, a sobering splash of cold water. And now we have to have the intention, the ongoing intention. It's wonderful. We could use that as a philosophy. Yes, I have to be connected. And what you would get from that philosophy is basically New Age speech. But you wouldn't necessarily get a different orientation to the world. Perhaps your heart has touched the truth of it, but you're not willing to hand your heart over with full-hearted attention to the problem. So now we have to line up to that, with that view, the wise view, and we have to bring forth an intentionality for our life, a resolve for our life, that we're going to use it from now on to make contact, to come closer together, to remove the isolation, to remove the distance. And that is what tools like mindfulness have been about. They are the first attempt, a very primitive attempt, if I can use that word, to begin to orient ourselves to the difficulty. And why do I call it primitive? It's primitive because we use the tool often without changing the view. It's us using a tool to try to get and make contact with something because we think it's going to be good for us. It's like taking cod liver oil, right? It's a burden. It's something else I have to do, but my teacher says. And so we do it, and it feels laborious. And that's why very quickly it gets eliminated in our life. Oh, from time to time we may remember it. But it's not a proper orientation because the view isn't often there. We don't know what we're doing, we just know we should be doing it. And until we know what we're doing and have the full-hearted intention to do it, because it makes complete sense to us, because we understand that if we don't, we hurt ourselves and we hurt the world through our inattention, through our disconnection. And we're tired of hurting the world, and we're tired of hurting ourselves. And so there comes this resolve of spirit, this confirmation of one's life that says, okay, it is not going to continue in this way. And when we take that on, then we bring the tools, mindfulness, which is the seventh step of the Eightfold Path. Why didn't the Buddha put it on top? Because you have to live the other six steps before mindfulness doesn't become a project in and of itself. So that it's a tool that flows from the deep inner longing to abide and to connect. So, as I mentioned last time, there is within us a deep, deep longing for that interconnection. It's as if we've forgotten everything else, but there's this tentacle, this one note that remains. The symphony has been denied or defended or resisted. The symphony of our togetherness. Just follow the metaphor. And so we've covered up with all of our argument, all of the trombone sections, the violins, everything. But one note gets through. It's impossible to cover it all out forever. And so every once in a while, there is this longing that gets through, where we feel as if there, the world and our place in it could be vastly different than what we seem to be in, the place we seem to be in. And that one note contains the theme. It's like, is it Rapunzel? Whoever threw out her hair or something out the window, and the prince crawled up her. So she threw out her hair, and I don't know what happened, but anyway, somehow he was able to climb up, not just on a single hair, but it's that hair that was able to, he was able to make into a thicker rope or whatever, and from that rope. I'm really sure. This story isn't going well. Anyway, forget it. We'll go a different direction. So it's that one note of longing that is all we need to awaken our heart, if we listen to it. Oftentimes that longing gets corrupted. Mostly it gets corrupted. It gets corrupted in form of a desire. What we want to do to self-improve so that we can feel as if we're moving in alignment with that longing. We corrupt it with the unwise view of life. We corrupt it with the sense of self and what the mechanisms and strategies of the self are. And so that one line gets corrupted through by the mind in its intentionality. But somehow, probably through the despondency, the growing despondency over time to people who are partially awake, which all of us are in here, or we wouldn't, why would we come here? For people who are partially awake, the despair is a call to action. It's an awakening, if we awaken through the despair, and often it is a motivation for further awakening, because we realize that we can't pretend that we're not doing it to ourselves. And at that point, a deep sense of resolve comes in, and the intention gets much clearer in accordance with wise view. I'm not going to work it at odds with itself anymore. I'm not going to use wise intention and unwise view and cripple the whole journey of my awakening, which we can do. So there are actually two levels of intentionality that play through most of our life. One level of intentionality is the intentionality to all the goals and ideals that we have had for us as individuals. All the wants and fears we have as individuals form themselves into day-to-day, moment-to-moment, and lifetime intentions called meaning, purpose, and all the other things that we. And then there's another level of intentionality, a deeper level of intentionality that comes from that single note of calling us, of the heart's opening, of the heart's calling. And it's a question mark on which level of intention we're going to play forth in our spiritual life. Now, often they don't interfere in this sense that you can go through school, you can be successful in what you do, as long as the inducements, you don't get sidetracked. As long as what you're doing it for is not self-promotion. You want to have a secure life, you achieve a certain financial stability, and that's accessible. Where it starts getting funny is when those side inducements of fame, notoriety, prestige, status, money, etc., become the very basis for why you live your life. Then that level of intentionality will interfere with the calling of your heart's longing. Because we will misinterpret that to mean more money, more status, more prestige. But when those two are very clearly seen, and at some point, that second longing we understand really has nothing to do with self-improvement at all. In fact, it has everything to do with self-understanding. It doesn't have anything to do with self-embellishment. Then we start moving in just the opposite direction. We start getting small. We start taking a nest in silence. We start listening for the songs to listen. We start listening for the songs of life. Now, which view we play out in our life will depend upon what we want from our life, because the reward will be in perfect alignment with the view that we hold. I was watching an interview with John Kerry, the comedian, and he was telling this interviewer what his life was like before he became famous. And he would go up somewhere in Hollywood Hills, and this is long before he was recognized and acknowledged. And he would sit in the car in the evening, and he would imagine himself with a like $7 million check. In fact, he would write a check out. He wrote a check out on his own checkbook for that amount and put it in his pocket, because that's what the best actors and comedians of the time were making per movie. And he would put that in his pocket, and he would raise himself up knowing that that was what he wanted and that was his intentionality for life until he was convinced that he could do it. Then he would go down and he would join his family or whatever and spend the evening buoyed by that sense of self-acknowledgement. And he did that every single night until he became known and famous and received a $7 million check. Now, you can make your life programmed in that way. If you have enough confidence, if you have enough self-assurance, that's really all it takes, self-belief. But we bring so much self-doubt is that we aren't able to master fully, even on the level of material gain. But you can do that. You can train yourself for that. And that will be your reward, perhaps a $7 million check or whatever it is that you and I most want out of life. That can be accomplished. And there have been books and workshops written about how to make yourself, you know, masterful. So the reward will be in a direct alignment, of course, to the view you hold of life. That is also true of wise view. If you hold it single-mindedly with a heartfelt intentionality and uncompromising love for it, so that everything comes to you in the nest of silence, in the nest of that intentionality, then awakening will be your prize. It cannot be stopped. It cannot be held back. You cannot arrest it. The only way you can arrest it is with mixed intentions. The only way you can arrest it is if you're not sure what you want. Or if you get these two different levels of intentionality mixed up. So that what you really want is to be awakened and to be acknowledged for your awakening. So that you can have all the pomp and ceremony and people around you acknowledging that and bringing you flowers. And hopefully chocolate. Because the reward will be in direct proportion to the fullness of your heart's intent. Now, one thing you can expect when you turn your life towards the difficult is that that difficulty in which we turn our life towards and the intentionality of working with that difficulty to begin to open ourselves more and more to the very self-inflicted ways that we cause that difficulty is that those lessons will become harder and more difficult. It's a little bit, I mean, if the universe is going to come at you in multiple ways in the beginning, and there are levels that we have to give up all along the way. We have to give up the minor ways that we irritate and resist life or hold it at bay before it starts, before we clear that out, and then it comes after the next layer, and then the next layer, and then the next layer, and then the next layer. And pretty soon, you have to face the most difficult issue that has kept you from your very awakening at some point. Whatever that issue might be, for some it might be self wanting to be a teacher or wanting to be recognized for the heartfelt compassion that they have. It doesn't matter what it is. It will dig it out of you. And then you will have to confront the deepest issue that lies between you and full surrender. We all have to do that. And the lessons do get harder. Here, just in a small example, I came back from Asia as a monk. I had no money. I landed at the Insight Meditation Society, and there was somebody staying there who did workshops for corporate executives. And he did Tai Chi, yoga, and did other things. And he said to me that he would like me, we got to know each other in the course of my being at the retreat center, he said he'd like me to teach the meditation aspect of this corporate workshop and that he could promise me a minimum of $50,000 for a week-long workshop. See, here I am, a begging bowl. I just put my begging bowl down. I just disrobed, and here I had no money and no real direction for life. And here was a possibility of something really giving me a much-needed boost financially. And I didn't do it. I didn't take it because it felt like I was, in some ways, at that point, it felt like I was prostituting the Dharma. That I'd be offering it to people who were not really sincere about learning the essence of what the Dharma was, but were going to use it, I don't know, for better peer relations or whatever. I don't know what it was. But it didn't catch me in the heart. It didn't align with what I wanted to use the Dharma for. I'm not saying it was wrong or bad. It just wasn't in alignment with what my own journey. And even though you could say, well, I can you know, so I'll go back to my journey after that week. No, I knew you don't do it that way. You just don't do it that way. You just don't do it that way. Idealistic? No, it's not idealism. It's just that when you know the tune, you know the note of that longing, you cannot allow much time to interfere or much separation or much turning away. You can't permit sort of a secondary experience to take over as primary and then turn yourself back around. That compromise, such a compromise for me, not for this person, that person was doing what he wanted to do, but for me would have been a devastation to the path itself. And once you do that, it's easier to do it the second time and to keep journeying your life just off the mark. Once you get induced into a side alignment, you miss the siren's call. And one's life begins to become taken over by something else. So these tests are part of the path, part of the journey. They have to be, because there are needs, our wants. They're going to come up, and they're going to face us. If we remember wise view, if we remember wise intention, it gets much easier to resolve these things. Now, in order to have a full-hearted intention, we, of course, need wise view to communicate that intentionality. And the second thing we need to do is to be unremitting in our willingness and our determination to abide in the present moment. Those two things, well, they're actually one and the same thing. Because when you abide in the present moment, abide in the present moment, not try to hold on to the present moment through mindfulness, but abide in the present, you see interconnectedly. And so you see that true interconnection comes from the present moment. And that the present moment and interconnection are one and the same thing. And that the more distance we place and put between our life, the more time, the more past, the more future, the more we want and wish and fear, things that will be happening, the more we are disconnected from the present moment and disconnected from life itself. So the present moment and this alignment with our wise view and abiding within wise view are one and the same thing. So what is it that makes it so hard to have a full-hearted intention? Well, one reason is that we have to be radically accountable to ourselves. We have to understand that we are our own worst enemy. In fact, we are our only enemy. And that reality is completely safe. We've got it all wrong. We think reality is the problem, and that we're trying to make ourselves safe from reality. There needs to be this reorganization. And so full accountability means I can escape from none of my projection. This is a term I'm going to use again and again and again, because it holds, from my point of view, an uncompromised view that reality is not the problem. In other words, we say, I am paining myself. Reality is not causing me pain. I am disappointing myself. I am angering myself. I am boring myself. Reality is never doing it to us. To have that certainty through self-discovery, you will see that that's the absolute truth. And when you know it to be the absolute truth, you will no longer put your woes and your despair upon the face of the earth. And because when you see that pain is self-inflicted, it causes forth an intentionality that is so resolute, that is so determined, because why would you want to keep hitting your knee with a hammer when you can put down the hammer? So you begin to sense, okay, this is essential for my understanding of interconnectedness, of a complete healing. The second thing that's important in this full-hearted intention is a complete exposure of ourselves, a complete opening, the willingness to stand naked, to put down all the defense and shields and armor that we have labored so hard to forge in our life to keep protected from. All of that needs to be sloughed off. Now, when I say that, it sounds like, oh, that's an impossible task. Well, that's what we're doing here, is making the impossible possible. That's what the homework is. Week after week after week, we hammer at this armor. We release another joint, another screw. We begin to dismantle it. And if we're willing to do this together, you're going to find that already your heart is very displayed to life, is very available to life. That's the indication that we are no longer very protected. You won't necessarily see anything dramatic. You'll just see a greater appreciation and a greater sensitivity in your life coming forth. So don't discount the fact that it's already well on its way with those of us who are here, because it quite likely is. It also means that we're going to be willing to risk. We're going to be willing to risk some of the things that we have plotted and planned out and carefully saved to see really what the universe calls forth from us. I think that this risk is going to be inevitable for us in this age. I think that we're going to, through just the drama of the times, be forced to risk as a culture. And at some point, I think we're going to all have to kind of bottom out together and understand that life just can't be lived on the dimensionality of mind that has led to so much separation and discord between us, that we have to move on now as a species without blame, without trying to pick the fault of the people who have led us into that. We've all led ourselves into that. There is no them that has led us into it. We've done it to ourselves. And when we can all agree that we just get moving now in a new dimensionality of life that's called forth for the salvation of the whole planet and as us as a species, then let's do it. Let's just go. But we have to be willing to risk it. Now, I had a meditation teacher of mine say that he wasn't going to buy a fuel economy auto until he was forced to do that. And I said, well, what's going to force you to do that if the circumstances in life, if the warmer weather in the planet isn't going to do it, what's going to do it? What's going to do it for us? Are we going to wait until everybody has to do it? The mixed intentionality is the problem. We keep bringing to the very reason that we live mixed intention, both the intention of fear and desire and that single note of the longing of reconnection, towards reconnection. That mixed intention is real interesting. Just on this last retreat that just got over on Friday, one of the retreatants, many of the retreatants said in the course of it, you know, they really liked the retreat and they kept longing to go back home. They kept longing to return to their life of familiarity, to their life of separation, to their life of in which they are familiarly in control. And yet, if they looked at their experience, they were enamored by the quality of their heart, by the aliveness of their attention, by the way that life was affecting them. And yet, at the same time, there was a compelling urge to return. So this mixed intentionality is going to be quite likely with us for a long period of time. This double message we're giving, where we don't want to mix up ourselves beyond repair, beyond recognition. We want to stay recognizable and be dharmic at the same time. We have to be aware of that. And we have to start using our life to see where it is that we're still resting upon the familiar and be willing to ask important, critical questions of that to test its viability, to test its reliability. We're the ones that are giving it, making it reliable, but is it reliable? And as we get more and more into the Dharma, you can begin to pick up the fact that much of what we call reliable is not. As a matter of fact, everything we call reliable isn't. And the willingness to look at it and to see that it is unreliable, to bring our death into the picture, and to hand in hand walk whatever we think is reliable beside the fact that we are going to die. If we're going to make this evolution of full-hearted intentionality from the mixed intentionality that most of us suffer with throughout our spiritual journey. Now, let's look at a few reasons why our intentionality is so mixed. One is that many of us are hesitant to give ourselves fully to the present moment, which is the full intentionality of interconnection. Remember that those are one and the same thing. Because we're so fearful of the past that might arise within us, our mistakes of a lifetime. When somebody is dying, they relive their mistakes of a lifetime. And we're afraid, if we sit quietly, that those same mistakes will arise within us, all those points of guilt and shame on our timeline we have to reconcile ourselves with, and all of the lack of forgiveness that we have lived with our life. We feel like if we sit still, those will catch up with us, that they'll overtake us, and that we'll be pulled down perhaps to the suffocating point. See, all of these different ways that we've been working have to do with, finally, a full intentionality. If we're not willing to look at our past as the past, if we're not willing to begin to work with the unforgiveness of our heart, both in things that people have done to us and things that we have done to others, then we're not going to be able to take our seat here in full intentionality. In fact, that's one of the reasons that the Buddha not only encouraged, but said it was the heart of his teaching, was ethical conduct. Because when we move ethically and conduct ourselves with integrity, you have no remorse. Things may not turn out the way we wish them to be, but you have no remorse about your intentionality or motivation for doing them. And when you don't have any remorse, you see that what happens in the course of the situation is really the universe's problem. Your job is to keep your intentionality and to keep learning as best you can. And when that is straightened, when that's in alignment with wise view, then we don't have any problem sitting down and being quiet. The second reason is that most of us feel like we're only partially evolved. We hold an ideal for our character, for our being, that hasn't presented itself, hasn't manifested. And we keep hoping that with a little more of this or that, a little more compassion, a little more love, a little more patience, a little more generosity, a little more time on the cushion, we will evolve sufficiently to be able to rest and take our seat. I've been doing it for more than 30 years, and I don't feel that I've lived up to my ideal at all. I don't feel like I'm even close to it. If what I projected back 30 years ago was some kind of pure-hearted being that only has love in their heart and never feels anger, disgust, hatred, or fear. But that isn't the point. That isn't the point of a full heart. A full heart rests with all things. A full heart does not look for one-sided appreciation. Full-heartedness is bringing the halves of what I should be together with the reality of what I am without problem, without argument. And then we can take the seat and see what is here. And it has nothing at all to do. Our mind states, in absolute terms, have nothing at all to do or limit awakening at all in this moment. Not even that much. Getting over your mind state is the problem, not the mind state itself. Having an ideal and resisting the state of mind is the problem, not the state of mind. The third reason is that we keep bringing strategies from unwise view into our resolve to be in the present moment, into our intentionality, our full-hearted intentionality. And we keep trying to control it, as I've mentioned many times. We keep trying to do it ourselves, have this thing under our control, our growth under our control. And we keep bringing in the same ways that we have moved through life into our spirituality. Avoid this and move where it's pleasant. And we keep trying to bring our agenda to what reality offers. And so we keep kind of trumping reality with our mind's intentionality. This is what I really want, and this is the way I'm moving. So we're never going to take a firm seat here and now as long as we're playing forth our desires and fears in the here and now. Just begin to listen to what a full-hearted intention demands of us. The next reason is that we're afraid of being exposed. Being exposed is one of the most fearful things. Being seen, if you see me for what I am and I don't believe myself to be much, what are you going to see? Not much. I think if you look and you see what I fear you're going to see, then I'm going to hide from you what's ever authentic within me because I don't trust what's authentic. And I'm afraid to be different. What if I'm exposed and I'm weird and you all turn your back and leave? See how this is, you know, we all hold each other in check through our judgment, through our I need to conform to be normal. But authenticity is what it means to abide and have a full-hearted intentionality and to abide in wise view. It's unscripted. It's unscripted. And if I'm afraid of what you think of me, that throws me back on my scripts, my commentary, my dis-ease of the mind, and that will keep me very noticeably in place and away from full-hearted intention. The sixth reason is that we don't really believe the Dharma. Not really. We kind of like, it sounds great, I like reading about it, it lifts my heart. But when we look around in the morning and everything seems so distinctly other than, which are we going to believe? Some book on our shelf or what our eyes seem to give certainty to? Therefore, I'll play with this because I feel that note of calling in my heart, but don't ask me to be really serious about it. I mean, I've got a life to live here. Doesn't that play in? Isn't there doubt in many of us about the Dharma? I'm just exposing some things here. And finally, a full intentionality requires interfacing with silence itself. The evil beyond evils. Why do I say that? Because in silence, with the end of my noise, the noise of me, the end of the noise of me, in silence, I end. No one's seeing me in silence. I don't have any prominence. I'm not recognized. Recognize me. Look at me. Look at me. We say frantic to assure ourselves that we're known to somebody. But silence doesn't hold that sense of personal recognition. It doesn't give me a platform. It doesn't give me a podium. There's no edge to it. That's why it's so powerful and so feared. And so why is it you think that when we sit down, the inward noise continues even though the outward noise has ceased? We're no longer actually verbally saying anything, but we carry that inward chatter. That's the chatter of self-confirmation. That continues because we need it. Because I think, therefore I am. And as long as we can continue to think, we can be assured of being someone. But that full intentionality of interconnection only happens in stillness. Who wants to go there? So, like many people, we test the grounds a little, up a little bit. I mean, just watch how a retreat unfolds. It's just so interesting. If you take all the personal issues out of it, which almost to a person no one can, but if you could, what you would see is the mind interfacing with stillness and that the noise of self-confirmation becoming less and less internally. And therefore, we bring up the drama of our lives so that we have something. Or the projects that we have yet to do, the productivity, so that we have something, some landscape to be known, some jungle that we've plotted the territory. But as all those jungles are asked through the instructions to be released and to be allowed and just to be observed, what happens is you can see it in the face and body of everyone in the retreat is a quieting, is a serenity, is a rejoining, a reconnecting, is a abiding. And yes, the noise continues sufficiently so that you still think you're there if you want self-confirmation. But the heart is leading it now, not the mind. And almost to a person, at some point on the retreat, if they did so, they could look at what they have come from and where they are now, and they would choose unanimously where they were now as opposed to what they had lived with their whole life. They say that. I can't believe how hectic my life is. I can't believe that. And yet, They go right back out into it the day the retreat ends and reconfirm themselves. Because it's so, because we talk, we argue against the possibility of its continuance. I can't live like this. The world will just squash me. Is that true? It's never going to happen if you keep arguing yourself out of it. You don't even give it a chance. The real truth is that what you want out of life, the mixed intentionality, is coming back to the surface. And what you need to get it is your noise, not your silence. And so we lose our silence. Not because anyone's taken it away, but because we've made a choice. We've signed the deal with the devil. End your noise. You end your being. You end your selfhood, your sense of self. And you see, the noise forces the world to externalize itself because the word is external to the living. And so as long as we can hold the world external and force a word upon it, then there's somebody who is having an experience of the world. And so we keep the noise going so that we can then use the world to get what we want. How can we get what we want when the world and ourselves is the same thing? We have to externalize the world in order to pursue it and fear it, in order to have a place in it. See, we have to be wiser than the strategies of separation. We have to be wiser than that in our meditation, in our daily life. And we have to have the resolve, full-hearted, to bring forth the energies, which will be the next talk. Wise effort. What is wise effort, given the intentionality and view now of interconnection? What is wise effort? Is it self-promoting effort? Is it ambitious effort? Given the fact that things are already together, where does effort come to play within that already togetherness? What is the definition of effort? It's very interesting how the whole thing changes when you just agree to follow the one note rather than the cacophony of noise around us. This is a single note intentionality. Single note. The bands are playing, but we are asked to follow a single note towards the nest of silence. And that requires us being small. It requires us listening in presence. And may that be so for all of us. Thank you. Can we sit for a minute or two? So if you have any questions or comments, I'd be happy to try to answer them. Yes.
It's kind of amazing that you talk tonight to me in this way. I just spent some days with a friend who's dying. It would be like weeks and months, maybe days, I don't know. And I certainly felt that note. And with deep appreciation in the way this person lives their life or has lived their life, and wanted to give me something. And it's just their way. It's just great, you know, just this sort of deep gratitude. And
so this woman was with a friend who is dying, and she was offered something, and she was unable to take it because of just a sense that it wasn't right for her to do so, and in the sense of your particular connection with the woman or whatever at that particular time in her life. And I just want to, you know, an intentionality brings its own reward. And when there's a deep intentionality for using life for what it really is there for, then the side inducements really aren't, I mean, it sounds like $50,000. What's the matter with you? But it's not like $50,000. If your heart is full, smelling a rose, then to take a trip away from that journey of being affected, even for a moment, feels much worse than leaving the $50,000 on the desk. It just doesn't, it's not equivocal. It doesn't sound from this level of intentionality or from the worldly sense of view that it makes any sense at all. But when, at times, when we abide in that moment, we see why people turn and do things which you never would do otherwise. And that those actions are so authentic because they're not motivated by external needs for goals. They're motivated by something else. Now, mostly we don't have that motivation, but sometimes, and believe me, there have been times when I've regretted not taking that $50,000. I'm not pure in that sense. I was in that moment, for whatever reason. There are moments of those when that occurs where you go, well, no, thank you. You know, you see what's a possibility, and you say, no, thank you. It comes from a different sense of what the ground, the figure ground is, than where we usually traverse. Yes. Right, right.
I'm just wondering that over time, does that habit that starts to get where you stay there longer? I mean, is it something that gains momentum?
Right. It's a good question. The question has to do with when this woman interfaces with stillness and quiet and meditation or whatever, it feels, she's almost drawn to it because it feels like a relief, a time to set aside her worries or her stress. But then after a while, it says, okay, now I've got to get back to my life. And the life continues on. And the question is, will this abidance in stillness grow on you? Does it become more appealing? It's not so much that it grows on you in that sense. It's that when you take it as a relief, you're really taking it from unwise view. You're looking for a way to have a little respite time. You know, a period of time in which you don't have the normal pressures of your life on you. But there's still you very much intact in that moment. The connection isn't really there fully. You're kind of allowing the difficulty to go into abeyance for a little bit. But knowing that or feeling that is you have to pick it back up and continue your life once the quiet is over. What we're suggesting is to understand that who we are is not the person that's just trying to find respite time. That this is a radical shift of inward perspective, so that there's no differentiation between the silence that we are accessing and the state of being. And therefore, we are coming from silence rather than trying to get to silence and over to offset some of our stress. We carry the silence internally, ongoingly. And therefore, the whole way of using life is not for doing a little bit of respite here, a little bit of relief here, a little bit of improvement there, kind of painting the surfaces of it to get back to what the real job at hand is, which is the burdens of the day and the tragedies of my drama. But to really say to yourself, there's no difference here. There's no separation here. There's no me and it. And that joining of life to itself can only happen in stillness. It's the joining that we're pointing to, not the relief. Relief is fun. Most of us use our meditation for partial relief. We've just gotten a therapist degree. We're more interested in being a therapist than in being quiet and letting therapy occur through that quietude. We're more interested in being well received in our profession than letting the quiet be the statement of whatever it is that we do and let people receive it. We just haven't learned the right orientation. And so we keep bringing ourselves again and again into the mix. What is this sense of self? Does it deserve that prominence? To look at that question, to ask ourselves the deepest question so that we can invite back that true harmony that we yearn through the note. It's just not a game, it's not a partial game. It's not a giving a little bit over to it. It's full-hearted. If you hold out any of your wants, then that is what that view will ascribe and reward you for. If you hold it out as being the object and purpose of your life, then that reward will be the reward of holding that view and that purpose. That's what you'll get. Think whatever it is that you want. If you don't get it in this life, you will get it in another life. And that will be your reward. Whatever it is that you want. President of the United States, that will be your reward. Now put yourself in that position. Children, happily married, whatever it is that you want. You can already get a feeling. Is it going to completely satisfy? Is it going to be the end of the story? Is that going to be the end of all of your story? The end of anything everlastingly so that you'll need or want? Obviously not. Okay, thank you all this evening.